Well, I guess it's now time for me to begin my presentation. When I was asked to speak upon this topic, the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, it took me a long time to remember this whole phrase. You know, it's so long. Several thoughts ran through my head. Take a look at the phrase, free and responsible search for truth and meaning. First of all, as a principle, this is a little bit odd, because a principle is a basic axiom or doctrine that's supposed to tell you what to do. This does not tell you what to do. It's kind of like, I think of it as a ginger ale or the 7-Up of our 7 principles. It's kind of the Uncola of our 7 principles. Perhaps if you heard the speaker Linda Thompson from a few weeks back, a more dignified way of putting this might be that this is the whole, this is the emptiness at the heart of our faith community. Or perhaps, as one person exclaimed when I revealed I was attending a Unitarian congregation, rather vehemently and none too politely, Unitarians don't believe in anything. This is not true, of course, if you look at our other principles. They are reasonably prescriptive, I think. They don't allow you to do just anything, because we must treat each other with respect and the world and the earth with respect. But you might say that this is not the kind of principle that just stands on its own. It needs to be surrounded by our other 7 principles, and we need to think about what it means. Another thought also flashed through my head. Is the search for meaning and truth in this day and age, when we have declining church attendance all over, is this actually being done? How many people actually engage in it? How important is it to people? So I set off on a quest in the last few months, because really I didn't have a huge philosophical background behind me, just those 2 thoughts in my brain to look at what this... No. Spacebar. Okay. To look at what these simple but terribly, I think, terribly important words might lead me. If you look at them, they're not terribly complicated. There's not like, nogenic or whatever I was seeing in some of the philosophy books. Free, responsible, truth, meaning. How does this play out, I thought? This principle kind of implies a question, not just what is the meaning, but why is the meaning so important for people? And perhaps, you know, why are we all here and not just sleeping in on the Sunday morning? Now, as I said, I didn't know what to expect, but I went to this old professor of mine who's helped me out very many times before, Professor Google, and typed in search for meaning in there, and what do you know? I found a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And it was by someone called Viktor Frankl. So I thought I'd better check this out. Here's the person. He was an Austrian psychiatrist. Perhaps, you know, just a little bit younger than the groundbreaking Freud. But he apparently also studied under Freud. He was a Jewish Viennese psychiatrist in that mold. But he was to develop theories that were markedly different. I'll explore that a bit later. And most notably, I think you'll notice from the dates, it was no accident he ended up in concentration camps, for them to be exact. And so here we are, another fall morning, and this is actually kind of appropriate that this is a war story, that my talk, which was first scheduled for December, ended up in November. I think this is a quite appropriate time to talk about this, because he was very marked by the experience. As you know, concentration camps, this has to be one of the bleakest, most hopeless chapters of human experience. And Viktor Frankl was not unaffected by this whole tragedy. He lost his parents, his brother, he lost his young wife, and only he and his sister escaped from the conflagration alive. And yet, Frankl posits that it is the search for meaning, and it is his conviction that it is to be found, that it is the most important part of one's life. So how could this conviction survive in a concentration camp? And also, he writes that this meaning is inextricably bound up with choice or freedom, and that freedom is bound up with responsibility. This is how Frankl thought of the two things. I'm in danger of falling off my stoop, which I think helps you, but that's a little bit wobbly for me. Freedom is in danger of degenerating into mere arbitrariness unless it is lived in terms of responsibleness. That is why I recommend the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast be supplemented by a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. Perhaps you might not understand that until maybe I say, maybe we could plonk the Statue of Responsibility down at Toronto Harbor, but perhaps such a serious topic, I shouldn't have said that, but I just can't help it. Frankl doesn't gloss over the pain and confusion and plain horror of concentration camp life. As you know, it was just this horribly disfigured world with topsy-turvy values. The sadists and the criminals rose to the top of the heap, and good people were just overwhelmed. But he spends much of the first half of his book examining the experience, not just to recount the horrors, but to give us an inkling on how this most extreme of human experiences affected not just the bodies, but the minds and feelings of the concentration camp inmates. Most of the prisoners, of course, were terribly ground down by the experience. One's energy just has to be seriously depleted and drained in such an environment. It even took a lot of energy just to keep your most minimal instinct, the will to survive, alive. He writes, the thought of suicide was entertained by nearly everyone, if only for a brief time. It was born of the hopelessness of the situation, the constant danger of death looming over daily and hourly, and the closeness of the death suffered by many of the others. From personal convictions, which will be mentioned later, I made myself a firm promise on my first evening in camp that I would not run into the wire. That is that electrified wire fence that provided a very easy method of escape for people. So we're starting right down here, right at rock bottom. And Frankl spent much time when he wasn't consumed by the problems that he was having, think about what would help keep him and his fellow inmates alive. There were many, many things in this environment that would kill you. There was no question. There was starvation, lack of sleep, sickness, beatings. And most of these elements, of course, are just were totally, totally out of your control. But he writes, there was one thing in your control that would kill you for sure. It was losing hope. It was losing the conviction that your life mattered, that somehow, all evidence at that point to the contrary, it had meaning. The prisoner who had lost faith in the future, he wrote, his future was doomed. And he also wrote about other things. Survival was not the only thing that people would think about in those circumstances, believe it or not. It was not the only thing that mattered. People could still feel, even though they were constantly being dehumanized, of some human values. In fact, in this heightened environment, the least betrayal by a fellow prisoner was felt all the more keenly. The least kindness by a guard, say a crust of bread, or as Frankl said, someone who looked at him and he could tell from that person's look that that person knew that he was human, even that would matter to you. And he writes as well, from all this we may learn that there are two races of men in this world. He didn't mean race in the usual sense, as you could well tell, but only these two. The race of the decent men and the race of the indecent men. And he writes on, therefore, I occasionally found a decent fellow among the camp guards. Now, I've heard different expressions for this. If I had grown up in a Christian family, perhaps people would have told me to be a good Christian, but naturally they didn't do that. But I was growing up with people who had an East European Jewish background, and often if they found someone admirable, they would say, oh, he's a real mensch. And that's the Yiddish expression, which just means you're a real human being. And I think Frankl would concur with that, whether or not he spoke Yiddish. Now, Frankl mentioned several examples of people who met their fates in the concentration camps with courage, and who gave courage to others. As one would expect, these people were in the minority, not the majority of inmates. Still, possibly because of their conviction, and even in this little Hell's Kitchen that he was in, he writes this. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And that was very, very important for him, helping him keep alive this feeling that he was human. There's also one incident he describes, despite this fact that he says most people were just so too ground down to be heroes. But I think this is quite the incident that proves humanity's stubbornness and his indomitable spirit. It's just curious. Listen to how he starts describing this. It had been a bad day. On parade, an announcement had been made about the many actions that would, from then on, be regarded as sabotage and thereby punishable by immediate death by hanging. A few days previously, a semi-starved prisoner had broken into the potato store to steal a few pounds of potatoes. The theft had been discovered, and some prisoners had recognized the burglars. When the camp authorities heard about it, they ordered that the guilty man be given up to them, or the whole camp would starve for a day. Naturally, the 2,500 men preferred to fast. Well, thank goodness none of us has been in that situation. And I just find it curious. He begins, it'd been a bad day, but in that situation, right at that point then and there, those people knew they were even in greater danger than before. They didn't have the luxury of looking back at their actions from a position of comfort, as we do. And the odds weren't too great that their brave action would benefit them. So Franco was asked finally by someone in charge of the blocks to speak to the people and counter the gloom and demoralization. This is in part what he said. Human life, under any circumstances, never ceases to have a meaning. And this infinite meaning of life includes suffering and dying, privation and death. He wished, I think, there to dignify not only the men he was talking to, their lives, but the lives of others who had been already lost. But even in peacetime, he did not lose this conviction. For I suppose, as you know, in the world, there's always unfairness. There's always suffering in the world, as we can see now in the Philippines. And then as individuals, we all must face death. Well, in the end, Viktor Frankl did survive. He went on. He eventually remarried. He taught. He practiced psychiatry, I think mostly in his homeland of Austria, and extensively lectured. So now we'll flip over to peacetime and look at the lessons that we can continue to take from those very extreme times. Frankl was interested in the problems we all faced, and that all indicate that we've lost our way. Things like drug addiction. He was interested in delinquents, people who were suicidal. He acknowledged that sometimes we could lose our sense of our being if we were unemployed. And he founded a new theory of psychiatry called logotherapy, from logos, which is the word for meaning in Greek. I think he had a very balanced view as to what could give meanings to one's life. And he lists three different possible ways. Some of them may resonate with you and some may not resonate quite so much. We can find meaning by creating a work or doing a deed. I think this is something we all know or all can relate to. By experiencing something or encountering someone, that is, by our love of nature, looking at culture, finding love. And then three, by the attitude we take to unavoidable suffering. That one I don't think is quite as well known or quite as accepted by North Americans. But by unavoidable, he meant just that. If your suffering was avoidable, by all means, do avoid it. Try to counter something. Try to fix right the wrongs that are holding you down. Otherwise, he says, well, you're just being a masochist. And he also had a balance, I think, on the first way of achieving some meaning. He knew people could strive too much for success, that we kind of worship that too much, and warned us that perhaps that really that wouldn't be the best to just think that that would fill our lives. And we all know of, especially pop stars, especially it seems like music stars, that seem to have it all, a great career, lots of fame, lots of success, and yet they're on drugs, their lives are just total messes. The last victim, Whitney Houston, you know, committing suicide. Anyways, he says of this, don't aim at success. The more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you're going to miss it. For success, like happiness, cannot be pursued, it must be ensued. Kind of that happiness should just land on you like a butterfly, because you're engaged with the world. You're engaged with other people, so you're not just thinking of yourself. And he also said, everyone has his own specific vocation or mission in life. Everyone must carry out a concrete assignment that demands fulfillment. Therein he cannot be replaced, nor can his life be repeated. Everyone's task is unique, as is his specific opportunity to implement it. So I think that goes well with our first principle about the value of each and everyone's lives, and also goes with his thought that during life we're going to get questioned by life itself what the meaning is for our lives. It's not something out there that we can kind of grab, but we have to kind of create it. He didn't dismiss the influence of that other psychiatrists talked about. He didn't dismiss the influence on us of heredity or the environment. This is where, as I said, he begins to differ from Freud and Adler, for instance, who talked a lot about our drives for pleasure, for sex, for power, and kind of divided of the human soul into all these different compartments. The id, the ego, the superego, and or perhaps other people in modern times who claim that what we really are all the time is consumers. But Frankl, this was not the essential component of humanness, that not all what we are. And he found that by just dividing us this way, by putting us into parts, by saying we were determined so much by heredity and environment, it was deterministic and reductionistic, that just kind of we lost all our freedom of choice by just thinking that those elements were at play. He didn't dismiss those elements entirely, but said, no, we're still free people with some choice. And this is a quote from not him, not Frankl, but a friend of his, but I think it really sums up most of his philosophy. A human being is not the sum of his past, but the father of his future. And that's by a friend, as I said, a fellow psychiatrist, Geronimo Acevedo. And I think that indicates that Viktor Frankl somehow came out of this whole experience still with ideas that can give all the rest of us a lot of hope. And then he also told this joke about the difference between being whole in your appreciation of humanity and kind of scattered into parts. And it's just, it's something I can't resist telling you, because this is one of those weird and really oddball Zen-like Jewish jokes that they may be a little hard to figure out at first, but I think they resonate. So I thought I'd leave by telling this. See if it'll mean to something like what I say, or maybe something different later. Anyways, it goes like this. A rabbi was consulted by two parishioners. One man contended that the other man's cat had stolen and eaten up 5 pounds of butter. And the other contended, well, this couldn't be so, because his cat didn't even like butter. So the rabbi said, bring me the cat. And the parishioners brought him the cat. Now he said, bring me the scales. And they brought him the scales. So how many pounds of butter did you say this cat had eaten? 5 pounds. So he put the cat on the scales, and lo and behold, what do you know? The cat weighed exactly 5 pounds. So, said the rabbi, now I have the butter, but where the heck is the cat? All right. So this is Frankl. He says, you can analyze yourself, you can say that you've got all these little parts in this butter and everything, but there's really something more. We're not just little pieces of this and that. And we have some meaning or purpose in our life beyond this. So I'm going to ask you now, I guess it's not too much time. We had a lot of announcements, a lot of concerns today, for your response, but maybe we can get one or two about people here, what you find meaningful, and perhaps if you find coming here to this congregation helps you find your purpose or your cat. And but just to give you a little time to think about that, I'll just say when I come here, I appreciate learning so much from other people. I appreciate being able to participate in the social action projects that, thank goodness, other people manage to organize and set up. And I also enjoy just knowing that there's more going on than I can do. And I also appreciate the freedom to learn from so many sources and so many traditions, not all my own. And thanks, everyone, for being here and listening today.